Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this rainy Thursday, the 3rd of April. I've been trying ever since I got up this morning to figure out how I feel because it's rainy and it's gloomy and it was, you know, the commute was just yucky coming in and all of that. And then by the time I sat down with my colleagues here in the room, I thought, oh, I know how I feel. I feel liberated. The liberation has taken over. I feel liberated. I hope you all do, too, and we'll talk about Liberation Day 2024, and we'll dig into that in just a moment. I actually was in New York City yesterday. I had the day off, and I went and I saw Good Night and Good Luck with George Clooney on Broadway, and my mug today is from See It Now, CBS, which was the program that Edward R. Murrow hosted, where he would say good night and good luck at the conclusion of that program about the McCarthy era and the downfall of Joe McCarthy. And
is that a newly acquired mug or one that you
This is a brand new mug that I got at the show. And very reasonably priced, Bill. I don't know
Broadway
if it was before or after tariffs, but it was very reasonably priced. But I thought, oh, this, and it's a great show. They do a fantastic job, but it's rather quaint. It doesn't really get into the, you know, you're like, oh, that happened. What we're going through seems a little worse. I don't know. This is, and we can certainly argue about that, and we're welcome to. Then I saw Othello with Denzel Washington and Jake Gyllenhaal. And it sucked. And that's my review. Okay. Good morning, all. Welcome. I hope you have a lovely, lovely day on this rainy day. We have a lot to talk about, and we're waiting, you know, about 15 minutes. We can all just sit and watch the Dow all day, and how fun will that be? We welcome three incredible panelists with us who will help bring us through the dink and the dank. And we begin with Bill Hammond, Senior Fellow for Health Policy, the Empire Center for Public Policy. Good morning. How are you?
I'm feeling liberated from my retirement savings.
Well, good. I'm glad in some way, even though it sounds discouraging, that you feel somewhat liberated. That is good. Judy Patrick is here, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
Well, I'm feeling liberated from my addiction to caffeine because I know the price of coffee is going to go up. And I thought maybe I'll go to tea. But then Mark Whitman has mentioned to me that tea is imported. So I'm just going to go with hot water going forward.
Yeah.
It's probably better for me anyway.
Probably.
That's why I'm liberated.
Probably. I will say, I don't want to steal Mark's thunder, but I will say that when Mark and I met at the coffee machine, he just looked at me and he goes, I don't think I want to be here today. Like, I don't think I want to have to talk about this. But he is, and he's a brave soul. Mark Whitman, investment banker on Wall Street. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. When can we just tell everyone we told you so? At what point are we liberated from the restraint that we've shown?
You know, I don't
are we there yet?
I don't know. That's a very good point. I don't know. Wherever there is, I hope we're close, because it's anyway, let's get to what's on your mind. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. So yesterday was Liberation Day. This has been talked about for several weeks, as the president said that this would be the greatest day in American history. And I believe he even likened it to the Declaration of Independence, I believe. I want to get the exact words, but I don't have them. I had them on my notes on another page, but that's okay. President Trump said Wednesday that he will impose a new 10% tariff on all all imported goods, along with higher import taxes tailored for each of about 60 countries that its advisors say maintain the largest barriers against U.S. products, and a sharp turn toward the kind of protectionism that the United States abandoned nearly a century ago. To impose the new tariffs, the president declared a national emergency, citing the annual merchandise trade deficit that the U.S. has run each year since 1975. For decades, our country has been looted, pillaged, raped, and plundered by nations near and far, both friend and foe alike, Trump said. But it is not going to happen anymore. The Trump tariff increases that the president announced had little modern precedent and would erect towering impediments to products from dozens of foreign countries, many of them poor nations that embraced exporting as a tool to escape grinding poverty. American importers, for example, will pay an additional 34% tariff on products from China, some of which already face 45% fees. Vietnam, which the administration says has become a transshipment point for Chinese companies seeking to dodge U.S. tariffs, will see its goods be hit with a 46% tariff. Cambodian goods likewise will be charged an additional 49% levy. Canada and Mexico, at least for now, face no new trade penalties, but of course were hit early on in this process. High tariffs and a range of other practices, including currency manipulation, value-added taxes, and product safety regulations, explain why the U.S. buys so much from the rest of the world than it sells to foreign customers, according to President Trump during a Rose Garden ceremony featuring a hard hat-clad union worker group, along with lawmakers and journalists. Erasing these persistent imbalances in global trade, which have hollowed out factory communities and weakened national defense, is now official U.S. policy, according to the executive order that the president signed on Wednesday. This all from the Washington Post, by the way. Speaking in blunt, sometimes intemperate language, the president assailed the nation's trading partners, including some of its closest allies, as foreign cheaters and foreign scavengers who had ripped off Americans for 50 years. Trump's tone echoed the dark portrait of American carnage that he had sketched in his first inaugural address in 2017. The early reaction from mainstream economists and business groups was grim, while industries that will enjoy new protection against foreign competition applauded, although Trump's announcement came after financial markets had closed. I'm sure that was a coincidence. Pre-market trading pushed U.S. financial markets sharply down late Wednesday, and all indicators are down this morning, and the Dow will open in just a matter of moments. In the short run, the effect is probably a recession. It's going to raise the price of so many goods that can't be made in the United States, said economist Brad Setzer of the Council of Foreign Relations. In the long run, it's a vision of the U.S. that is very isolated from the rest of the world. Okay, that is what we will grab onto in the beginning as our setup for this story, and because he's so excited to talk about it, we begin with Mark Whitman.
Yeah. So, Joe, the United States started lowering its trade barriers and tariffs with the rest of the world during FDR's administration. And although there had been fluctuations in the line, it had gone ever lower. And as those lowered, we became the world's wealthiest, most powerful country. And I don't, and many economists and political theorists believe that's not an accident. But if you listen to Donald Trump, right, we are a victim. And now it's time to fight, fight, fight. So he wants Liberation Day. He's going to liberate Americans from their savings and earnings as they pay higher prices for the same, for actually a smaller set of choices of goods. He's going to liberate American corporations from some of their profits as they absorb some of these tariffs and also face the costs of rearranging their business activities to try and minimize these tariffs. He's going to liberate the United States from some of its geopolitical power that comes from our centrality in the world's economy. And who benefits as a result? Well, that's a good question, because if you take the simple definition of a tariff, it's a tax. It's collected by the U.S. government. So government revenues are going to go up. But we know that Trump's intent is to use that increase in revenues to help at least fig leaf cover his tax policy, which is going to enrich corporations and the wealthiest Americans generally at the expense of the less well-off in this country. So he's also liberating us from the principle or the goal of achieving greater economic equality in this country. And also, he liberates us from some of our geopolitical influence around the world. He has already begun to increase the geopolitical influence of large exporters who are going to be desperately in search of markets for their goods, including Canada. I'm sorry, including, Canada's one, but more importantly, in a geopolitical sense, China, which just, I think, a week or two ago there was an unprecedented meeting between South Korea, Japan, and China at the level that hadn't taken place for years. And it was essentially a planning meeting to decide how to respond to the pending tariffs from the United States. So if Donald Trump's goal was that type of liberation, he's going to succeed. The other thing that makes this even more frustrating is Donald Trump is a serial liar. He's also mercurial. So to take anything he says today as a expression of policy that's likely to continue into the future, even to the end of his administration, would be a huge mistake. And so corporations in the United States and actually around the world will be somewhat paralyzed as they try to figure out what happens here. The other, obviously, we've talked about this before, but it's been interesting to hear Donald Trump's press secretary and Scott Bessent, who, by the way, Scott Bessent, I put now in the category with Marco Rubio, is somebody who you thought you respected, but now has been so sucked into the maelstrom around Trump that it's impossible to do so. But Bessent basically said, look, don't retaliate us against us. Take a deep breath. And what he means is, call me or the administration and we'll see what we can work out before you get too panicked. That's part of that implicit message. So the opportunity for Washington now to become even more of a swamp of lobbying and you know, improper horse trading. I mean, it literally, we have increased the pot of gold for nefarious dealings in Washington by multiples.
So here's my question, and we'll go to the rest of the group in a moment, and whoever wants to field this, actually. But none of this, as far as the general public and the market certainly, have reacted well to the early tariff announcements from this administration. And I'm just wondering, when you see what has happened and the reaction, and often then the turnaround by the administration that said the tariffs are on, the tariffs are off, the tariffs are on, the tariffs are off, of what then would possess you to say, well, let's make April 2nd Liberation Day, and we're going to do everything we did to these disparate places, and we're going to do it to everybody, of how that makes sense.
Yeah, my true belief is that Donald Trump and some of the theorists that he deals with have a profound misunderstanding of how the world works. And I don't know how firmly they believe it. I believe this. I think Donald Trump realizes that this, again, makes him the center of attention in a way, particularly globally, both in domestically and internationally, in a way that almost nothing else would. And I think for him, that seals the deal. Look, Donald Trump was elected to try and deal with the malaise of Americans' affordability crisis, homes, cars, education, medical care. He has done nothing to address those in any meaningful way, and this will exacerbate those crises. He and the Republicans are going to ignore the consequences of this at their own peril.
So there's like I think part of what makes this so dangerous and scary, honestly, is that it's an authority that the president wields with absolutely no check. I mean, there's the theoretical check of Congress, but they granted the president this power. They could pull it back. They could specifically cancel all of what he did yesterday. But that's not in the cards, right? He enjoys too much support in Congress. But that means it all, the policy is whatever comes out of his head on any given day, at any given hour of any given day. There was some coverage of the behind-the-scenes debate over what they were going to announce.
Yes.
They decided, okay, well, let's do 20% across the board, just so everybody knows, like just to have a blanket thing that encourages reinvestment in the U.S., and then we'll have customized rates for certain countries. Well, then they decide, no, maybe not 20%, 10%. How about 10%? It's whatever he wants to do. There's no like theoretical groundwork behind this.
No data was involved in this decision.
No, there was data involved. Apparently, they sort of back-ended their way into these rates by taking a combination of the trade deficit, the existing tariffs, the whatever VAT taxes. Like, it's a mysterious formula. Some people reverse engineered it and they figured it out. But the mercurial is too weak of a word for this. It's because, as you just indicated, he could back off on all of these decisions tomorrow. If he does that, will we all breathe a sigh of relief? Not necessarily, because he could put them back on the day after. And really, I'm not necessarily optimistic that this is how it's going to play out, but if things get bad enough, Congress might actually step up and call the whole thing off. But it might have to wait until this Congress is unelected.
But he would,
which means we have to wait 2 years.
Well, but he would veto that bill, though.
I mean, we have seen. We have seen the Senate just in the last 24 hours, at least four Republican members who have spoken out against some of the tariffs and trying to reduce those. But that's a far cry from then going to the House.
Yeah, you'd have to get past. You'd have to pass legislation. There are two.
Well,
there are two ways.
Bad enough, you'll get 2/3 votes.
Yeah,
to override.
I think that's extraordinarily unlikely. There are two ways to foil this sort of mechanically within our system. One is to get a veto-proof majority in both houses. Highly unlikely. The other way to do it is to go to court, and I think this is more likely. And say, look, we gave you "quote unquote" emergency power, but for instance, you're levying billions of dollars, I don't know, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars worth of tariffs on Canada because there were 42 pounds of fentanyl that crossed the border in the last year. I'm going to get – those numbers aren't exactly right, but you get the point. And any reasonable person – I mean, if you got 10 reasonable Americans in the room and said, is that an emergency that justifies what we've done, the answer is hell no. So that's the other way to come at this. And my understanding is somebody's already – on the route to trying that in court, but I hold little hope that either of those two solutions will be effective and timely.
Judy Patrick.
So it's the instability of it all, I think, that's so shocking. What we're hearing today from people around the world is they were anticipating these tariffs, but they didn't know they'd be so egregious, so high, so blatant. You know what? I kept on saying to myself, why are we doing this? And the ostensible reason is to bring manufacturing back to the United States, to increase manufacturing. And I agree, there's a place in our economy for manufacturing. But as someone who comes from a long line of mill workers, let me tell you that the job of a mill worker is not a fun job. It's physically demanding. It's mentally demanding. The wages are not great. I mean, I understand that some of those auto plants in Detroit, they all make healthy wages, but I can't see the condos in Saratoga Springs that have been converted into from old knitting mills being returned to paper mills. The paper mills in Greenwich aren't coming back. I we do not have low employment. We have a fairly good, healthy labor market. So who's benefiting from this? I think the big businesses will benefit, and I think he, as the American-made business, I think there's going to be some money that will flow their way. But the consumer, like as a consumer, it's a lose-lose-lose. I saw a CNN poll where 5% of Americans somehow think these tariffs are going to lower costs. Like, I want to talk to those people. Why? How? Where is this going to happen?
Judy, on a net basis, American corporations will not benefit from this. You know, the weird thing about this policy, and I heard this expressed, I should credit someone other than me, it may have been at the Financial Times, said that the costs of globalization, if you think about it, benefited everybody. We all paid more. We paid less for blow molded plastic toys, and then for knit goods, and then for electronics. And the costs, unfortunately, were borne in the United States in very localized, mostly internal towns that where the production, manufacturing, whatever you want to call it, was hollowed out. The problem with Donald Trump's policy is he's inverting that. Everybody's going to pay much higher costs for their goods. Unfortunately, you can't bring back labor in the same way. Number one, it takes a couple years to build these factories, and you sort of need a 10-year runway of visibility before you make that investment. And he can't offer that given the inherent uncertainty of both his policy and the next administration's. And beyond that, there is a secular global decline in manufacturing jobs. So you think about Germany. Germany, if we were in Germany, we would be having today a discussion about the secular decline of our manufacturing sector. Why? Because as automation takes over, it's just inherent that people have replaced people with machinery. And I'll give you a great example. I've been through hundreds of tours of food manufacturing facilities in my career. And for the first 10 years, you basically, through the production of this, so let's say cookies were rolling off the line, you'd see these enormous machines and maybe 5 or 6 people who were looking at the computer screens making sure everything was working. You'd see 5 or 6 people, maybe 10, 15 people loading material on, and then another maybe 20 people in the packing area because the machinery for the packing area was really hard to get right and needed a lot of labor. Over the decades, that packing area now has 3 or 4 people looking at computers. The robotics folks have figured it out. And that's just the way the world's going to go no matter what Donald Trump tries to do with trade policy.
So as of 9:30 in the opening of the market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled over 1,200 points or 2.9% Thursday. Within minutes of the opening bell, the broader S&P 500 index sank 3.4%, and I believe the NASDAQ is down 4.4%. So
this is we're all getting a lesson in the difference between zero sum and what's the alternative to zero sum? Win-win.
Cooperation.
Yeah, so President Trump seems to believe that international trade is a zero-sum game, that any gain that somebody in China or Vietnam or Germany or Canada gets is our loss. And that's just not the fact of the situation. Free trade is a win-win. You know, we get cheaper goods, the other country gets economic activity. And in fact, what we can manufacture more efficiently, we will manufacture. And so everybody can benefit when it's done properly.
I'm not asking anyone on this panel to get into the mind of Donald Trump, but I am curious as to whether you think that as this announcement was being made on the lawn of the Rose Garden in the White House, that he anticipated, expected, was waiting for the reaction of the markets.
They waited until the market closed to do the announcement.
Well, correct.
They knew there was that risk.
But I mean, it couldn't have come as a surprise.
And they've been telling us to brace for short-term pain. So they're ginning up their base to realize that this is going to hurt. And short term is a relative term. There's going to be pain. They know that this is going to hurt. I can't. Again, I want the freedom as an American to buy whatever I want. That's legal. but if I want to buy a foreign-made car, I want to buy that car. If I want to buy an Irish sweater, I don't want some sort of excessive price put on it. I mean, that's what I have loved about the last 20 years. Maybe this will lessen my consumption, which maybe I'm trying to look on the bright side of things. But but you know, as we think about, well, is my washing machine going to go? Should I buy it today or wait until it fails when the price is probably going to go up? I mean, I've gone through this Buy American phase with our government many times. We did it through the Bush administration. I think we did it a little bit through Carter. And you know, is your American flag, is it made in America? You know, we've gone through this so many times, and it's never turned out well. We are going to pay more for American-made goods because, I mean, partly because the demand is going to be higher because there's going to be less competition. Isn't that basic?
Well, you don't always pay more for American-made goods. There are some goods at which Americans have an absolute advantage, but you know, there's so much to sort through here. Joe, the one thing I would say about the market reaction is Trump's lucky he's a liar, because if the market thought if the market thought that poster board from, I think he took that from The Price is Right with all those tariff rates, if that was actually going to be the final end product here, the markets would be reacting far more severely than they are now. And as a matter of fact, the markets can get themselves somewhat comfortable with, okay, the next however many years are going to stink, but the next administration's never going to perpetuate most of this.
That graphic looked like the leaderboard from Bedminster. Yeah. Repurposed.
Well, you know, it wasn't that, because if the leaderboard from Bedminster were in Donald Trump's hands, he'd have been at the top.
He always will be at the top. Well, even in this case, right? Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversations. Plenty of letters from listeners. We'll get to those as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable, thank you very much for being with us. We want to get to letters here, but this from the Washington Post, an analysis by Glenn Kessler. Trump's speech announcing a huge increase in tariffs on American trading partners was riddled with falsehoods and misleading statements on trade that he has made for years, but now they are determining policy that will increase the cost of goods for many Americans. Here's a quick sampling in the order in which he made them. We're sure we missed some, says Kessler, and some claims still require more checking. Won't do all of these, of course, but just a couple. For years, hardworking American citizens who were forced to sit on the sidelines as other nations got rich and powerful, much of it at our expense. But now it's our turn to prosper, and in doing so, use trillions and trillions of dollars to reduce our taxes and pay down our national debt. This is exaggerated, says Kessler. In Trump's telling, the U.S. is a poor country beset by outside forces. Not only does the U.S. have the largest gross domestic product in the world, but its per capita GDP is much higher than any large country. Then we go to the next one, which is the U.S. charges other countries only a 2.4% tariff on motorcycles. Meanwhile, Thailand and others are charging much higher prices, like 60%. India charges 70%, Vietnam charges 75%, and others are even higher than that. Likewise, until today, the U.S. has for decades charged a 2.5% tariff. Think of that 2.5% on foreign-made automobiles. The European Union charges us more than 10% tariffs. And Kessler says, well, these numbers are suspect. India charges a 50% tariff on motorcycles, not 70%, and recently announced a cut to 40%. In any case, Harley-Davidson already got around that duty by assembling in India most of the motorcycles sold in the country. And then just one more before we move on. Canada, by the way, imposes a 250 to 300% tariff on many of our dairy products. They do the first can of milk,
They do the first little carton of milk at a very low price, but after that it gets bad. And then it gets up to 275-300%, he said. Kessler says Trump has forgotten that he fixed this. The high dairy tariffs largely eliminated in Trump's renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement during his first term. Now it only kicks in after the U.S. has hit a certain level of tariff-free sales in a year, which has not yet happened in the U.S. So those are just three examples.
You know, I was out in my garden listening to this yesterday afternoon, when you're listening to the President of the United States, you try to believe what he says, I'm not an economist. I don't even like talking about it. But listening to it, I'm thinking, oh, well, maybe he's right. And you can understand why people would be supportive of this. And then that's why I think the media, we all have a really important job to do to try to explain when he does not tell the truth, when he lies, and try to put this forward in a far more rational manner. I've been on social media in the last 12 hours watching Trump supporters who continue to believe these tariffs are a good thing and that some he's going to send them a check of some sort or he's going to give them new services because of this tariff because they listen to him and they believe what he says because he's the duly elected president of the United States.
Joe, I want to use your Washington Post article to just jump off on something. First of all, that I read either that one or one that was similar to it, but generally right. But I will say there are even sort of second level complicating factors. If you are if there were a U.S. dairy producer in the room, they would jump up and down as you read that because they would tell you that there are health and safety standards as well as an ingredient and labeling rules in Canada, which serve as a further impediment for exports from the United States into Canada. So Donald Trump's not right. The editor's not, or the author of that article's not entirely right. But it does raise an issue with what Donald Trump's trying to do that I saw. And if any of your listeners saw this article, if they don't, I'm sorry to use your inbox as my reference point, but if they saw the article, I'd love to re-find it. I read it, put it away, and then couldn't re-find it. But there was an article that said, okay, look at, for instance, how complicated tariffs already are. And they said, they focused in on tea, ironically, if you think about the historical reasons for that. And they said, okay, so here's the category for tea, non-fermented in satchels of a size from X to Y. And they said, if you're the import tax people in the United States, you've got to run down the sheet, find that column, and then find what the taxes are. Now, under Donald Trump's regime, you have to go through the next column that includes all of the countries that import tea and find out what level of tariff gets applied to that. The administrative burden that if this were to be enacted, Donald Trump is going to create could not be fulfilled in the short, or I dare say, even in the intermediate run. I mean, they just literally don't have the bureaucratic infrastructure, and it would be incredibly daunting to set that up. It's some of this and the consequences of what he says he wants to do are literally mind-numbing when you think about them.
One of the ironies for me anyway is that when I was a younger person, it was mostly the Democrats who were skeptical of free trade. They were kind of in line with the labor unions who worried about manufacturing going overseas. They were worried that other countries didn't have the same labor standards or environmental standards or safety standards, all of which are still concerns that you hear aired. But it was more the centrist in both parties, the sort of realists and the moderates who would stand up and say, we have to remember the huge value that we get from free trade, the value we get economically, the value we get in terms of our influence in the world. And it's just now we're in a situation where because of negative polarization, it's going to be Democrats and liberals who are going to be suddenly diehard free trade proponents. But I just hope they remember that when the time comes, when like there's a new president and it's not from the Republican Party, And are they, you know, are they gonna see the wisdom of going back to free trade?
You know, this implementation of all these tariffs does not sound very efficient. And we've been trying to root out inefficiencies in government. There's some talk last night that some of these things were generated by or reviewed by AI, and that's why you saw a tariff imposed on, Antarctica?
This island with only penguins.
With only penguins, and territories with only U.S. military people on board. So AI is not the solution to this. I think the American public, the world is going to get a real lesson about the dynamics of free trade. And let's not forget the people in other countries are pretty annoyed at us. And I think there's going to be a call from within their populaces to strike back. I think this can really accelerate and be damaging to the whole world's economy.
Well, that's an interesting question, Judy, because you think about it, right? A tax is just a trade on your own. A tariff is just a tax. On your own people. So if you're in, say, Canada and you want to get upset, it's like, well, we're going to start to tariff your goods, which means we're going to charge our own people more to buy them, which is damaging. Now, and the other option that the Canadians have done, which is to take some items just entirely off the shelves. I think they've done that, at least in some provinces, with some of the United States spirits brands. But that's you're literally biting your nose to spite your face. It is true, as Scott Bessin said. It's he's obviously a smart guy, but you can see the Kool-Aid mustache forming.
Never.
He
a good
said,
look,
take a breath and before you retaliate, because it is true that because we are such a huge net importer with all of these countries, if we start the war, the United States may not win. But the country on the other side will always lose that war.
I guess one commentator that I follow on Twitter, Josh Barrow, was pointing out, you know, that point of view only makes sense if you assume that the other countries don't have politics.
Like, yes.
The other That's countries right. have their own internal politics. And when they get attacked, when they see President Trump doing something like this, it's very hard for them not to respond.
No, I think that's a very good addition. And if I may, you saw that with Zelensky, right? Because from a clear sort of horse trading standpoint, he probably shouldn't have stood up as much as he did in that. You could argue he might not have wanted to stand up as much as he did in the Oval Office, but his popularity back in Ukraine soared as a result. So your point about sometimes people just get so mad that they're willing to spend something to spite their enemy, that's a political calculation that's often true.
Right, and you're going to see more of these alliances. I think the EU has their population says we have to stick together on this one. We have to, you know, none of us can break apart. Our strength is acting as a union, not just France, not just Germany, but working together to fight back.
Well, not only fight back, but create trade blocks amongst themselves. The one thing I will say is Trump has called an economic question in China that's going to be really hard for that government to answer because they've already been dealing with difficulties over there and sort of using half measures that weren't going to work to try and address them. And now their economic malaise will get even deeper. So he has made Xi's short and intermediate term economic plans a lot more difficult. But just
also given Xi a convenient scapegoat.
Yeah, a little bit. But I think his people are still going to be pretty unhappy. But let's just look at this premise of trade. You know, we used to buy blow-molded plastic toys in the United States, and the Chinese came in and said, hey, we can make that stuff for a fourth of the price. So you spent probably less, bought your toddler a few more of those damn blow-molded plastic toys. We gave the Chinese U.S. dollars, and then they said, well, what in the world do I do with these U.S. dollars? And they looked back at the United States, and they said, you know, that's a pretty good economic bet that economy will continue to perform. I'll go ahead and buy some of their U.S. Treasury bonds, or I'll invest in their equities. And what do we do with that money? We build roads and bridges, or we build companies in the United States that generally we tend, if you look at our exports to the world, tend to be services and technology related, where we grew. It was a great deal. Nobody was ripping us off. And now for Trump, you know, to start to use the language that he did, and if I may, just one more footnote on that. for that man, given what a New York judge said about his conduct, to use the terms rape and pillage, for Trump to use those terms, it just, it makes my skin crawl when I hear that, aside from pure economic calculations, frankly.
Let's get to some letters. We have many. Ken says, I would like to comment that aren't these tariffs reflective of the actual price of goods that come from these countries? Couldn't they help us as Americans to reduce consumption of cheap products made overseas, overall reducing the environmental impact of buying such goods? In the end, this is a win for the environment, a Democrat trying to stay positive.
Yeah,
Ken.
Ken has a really good point to think about that, but I don't think it's complete, and here's why. I do think if you look at like the manufacturing of all those batteries, you know, the AA, AAA, all the normal type of batteries that you put, there's a reason why those are done overseas. It's probably some of it's probably not a good reason, i.e. the, you know, the holding pond in the back of those facilities overseas are things that we would never accept here. So tariffs aren't always a bad thing. If you want to say to a country, until and unless you're not abusing the environment and your people, we're going to slap a stiff tariff or not even buy your stuff. Ken's right. That's very effective. But what's going to happen, Ken, and I'll use an example that probably isn't entirely true, but just to make the point, we don't grow economically viable quantities of bananas in this country. But let's say we started to. Well, what would we do? We'd have to pour all this nitrogen and other crap into the soil to get it to produce bananas that grow very, very, very much more naturally in Costa Rica. That's got an environmental cost. So the inefficiency here of trying to, you know, mine copper in places where it's even harder to get out of the ground, or to grow bananas where you really shouldn't be, or to do things far more inefficiently because there's this artificial tax in the way. I don't think, as a matter of fact, there's no way that the environment is a Mother Nature is not happy. There's a reason it's raining today, and it's because she too has been liberated from improvements around global environmental policy by this policy.
If you wanted to use tariffs to implement environmental policy or labor policy or whatever else, you would need to have a nexus between the tariff and the environmental policy. There is nothing even approaching that, right? So imagine there is a country, I don't know the right country to identify, but some major trade partner. They were abusing the environment. We put pressure on them in trade negotiations. They agreed to improve their environmental standards. We've come to terms with that, and now we're slapping them with a tariff. We're punishing them for having come to terms.
Yeah, well,
the
MCA, you know, our trade agreement with the United States, Mexico, and Canada, did deal with labor and environmental standards. Those protections are allegedly in there. I'm sure there's a list of transgressions that should have been covered that weren't, but there was an attempt to do that. So your point is when you then detach the two, right, blow it up, right, the inefficiencies that result in terms of the sort of you have to do dumb stuff to the environment in order to get the same goods and services or some of the same goods and services provided to people, it's deleterious to the environment. It's not a benefit.
Right, and the environment's important, but the labor issue is important as well because we have people working in slave labor conditions in some of these countries to produce these cheap T-shirts that we wear.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, 50. We have 50 letters. so we'll get to those on the other side of a break. And we welcome you to add to the pile, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning, Bill Hammond is with us, senior fellow for health policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, is here, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. We welcome you and your letters, panel@wamc.org. We are talking about stocks falling, businesses recoiling after Trump imposes tariffs that were announced yesterday as part of Liberation Day. We have a lot of letters from listeners, so let me get to as many as I possibly can in the time that we have before, because there are other topics I want to move on to.
Matt says, with respect, I believe you're missing the point entirely. Donald Trump wants to become Putin. His plan to break things down so he can come and rescue us. He's lawless, and the consequences of his actions now mean nothing to him. It's all according to plan. Then we go to Rob, who has a legitimate question for the group. In your opinion, what are the chances of the U.S. going into a depression?
That is, I mean, isn't that part of the story, the Great Depression? I'll defer to Mark.
The Smoot-Hawley tariffs. I think most economists would agree that the Smoot-Hawley tariffs deepened the depression but did not cause it. I think there's, you know, Goldman Sachs has the 30% chance we go into a recession next year. That was before this, that those chances have to have only increased. I think a depression would be extraordinarily unlikely.
All right.
That's the kind of thing that would get you the two-thirds majority in Congress that we were talking about before. But the thing is that everything lags, right? So it'll take us a while for us to feel the effects. I mean, other than in our IRAs, we're already feeling those effects. But in terms of prices of cars and sneakers and stuff, that'll take a while for it to filter into our lives. And then that has to filter into politics. And, you know, the election cycle, we're not going to elect a new Congress until next year. So I don't know.
I actually don't think it takes that long. I think you'll start to see some of the effects on bigger ticket items very soon.
We go to this story from listener Pat. When I was a kid in the late 60s, I went to a clothing store with my grandfather while he shopped for a new jacket. He was a Beechnut factory worker in Canajoharie. He was a well-read, blue-collar kind of guy. As he searched through the jackets in one of the stores, he became angry because many of the manufacturers were from other countries. He went to the front counter and asked for the owner of the shop. My grandfather really got on the owner about not supporting American workers. The owner responded by saying that what Americans cared about were cheaper goods. My grandfather exploded. We went to a different store where he purchased an American-made jacket. My point is that the shop owner was right. The average American is not willing to pay higher prices for American goods. I have two kinds of socks in my sock drawer. The socks from Vietnam were $4. The socks made in Vermont were $24 a pair. Manufacturing isn't going to return. But aren't they warm and comfy? Manufacturing isn't going to return in the U.S. unless Americans are willing to buy $24 socks.
You know, it's not just a question of cheapness, though. Like, I think one of the miracles of modern society is the grocery store. And you go in and you look at the produce aisle or the fish counter or the meat counter, and there are foods I did not even know existed when I was a teenager. And they're all, and it's year-round. You can buy blueberries year-round. You can buy salmon year-round. And why is that? Because of global trade. And now, I think a lot of Americans like avocados. Most of them come from Mexico. The good kind come from Mexico.
Judy's looking to get more on her way home.
If you shut down international trade, it's not a question of paying more for avocados. You're just not going to be able to buy avocados, or at least not the good ones. So it's more than just a question of Americans being cheap, although it's another way of saying Americans are good bargain hunters.
What will we do with our toast?
So yes. Just to go to that point, of the other thing, if you take the auto tariffs and if they all go into effect as currently constituted, some of the lower price models will be unavailable in the United States. So entry level buyers will pay. And once some are less available, all of them will go up in price, even the United States, mostly
used
manufactured.
Cars, everything.
So then everybody runs to the used car market, by the way, because the idiosyncrasies around COVID is already pretty expensive. It's just going to get worse. And there will be people bereft of reliable transportation, not because they aren't willing to buy foreign, but because they can't. So I get the letter writer's point. And by the way, her knowledge of the fact that the Vermont socks cost exactly how much she knew just speaks to why she bought them. She didn't buy them as socks. She bought them almost as a wine, as a story she could tell because she wants to support something. But if you want a car to get to work and that's all you need is a pair of wheels to go to the job that supports your family, you're not about stories. You're about what you can afford. And some people are going to end up in far less reliable transportation because of what Donald Trump's doing.
So John says, bringing jobs back, I don't think so. If you were a foreign manufacturer, would you now think that opening a plant in the United States is a good idea? Then there is this. Has anyone asked how so much of American manufacturing got transferred to foreign countries in the first place? Did corporate search for cheap labor have anything to do with it? Does anyone think tariffs will lower the cost of American labor, or is that part of the plan? Is there a plan?
Tariffs are only going to the extent that these tariffs bring jobs back and our labor market is already near full employment, we're just going to do two things. We're going to make more in the United States with more capital. And I use the example of, you know, going to your local fast food place and ordering off the board instead of a person. I mean, that's sort of the answer to increased minimum wage is something, a machine that can do what the person does. Or you're going to pay that person more, in which the person more that stays on, and that's going to make the American produced goods cost more. If the only thing you wanted to do was bring back American jobs, you'd be better off just paying people in most cases to stay at home and forget this whole tariff regime. Now, that's an incomplete picture because the United States government is picking up the bulk of the value here. But that value is not being used in a way that's going to benefit, you know, Trump's base. It's being used in a way to as a fig leaf for his tax cuts, which are going to perpetuate and accentuate the economic inequality in this country. I mean, he's really doing a number on his base with this stuff.
You know, the big carpet mills in Amsterdam started to, you know, reduce in size back in the 1920s and 1930s, and it really accelerated when I was there in the 70s and 80s. And the reason the companies would always tell us is that it was cheaper, especially when it came to labor, to produce these carpets in Mexico, for example. They even had, Coleco had a one of those plastic mold factories in Amsterdam in the probably early 80s. And eventually they switched to some sort of computer, some weird computer game. But that didn't work. And now those buildings
Coleco.
Have been... Coleco, yeah. But they did those plastic mold things. But, weren't a ton of people working there doing that. But they produced quite a bit of... I don't know if they were swimming pools or what. But the carpet mills, I mean, if you look at Amsterdam, all those big buildings, some of them are gone now. It was a rug city. And this is the decline that started well before, 1960. This was a decades-long decline.
ColecoVision. Remember ColecoVision? I
remotely.
Yeah. I think they were part of Donkey Kong in that,
yes,
in that franchise. Yeah. Okay.
I loved Donkey Kong.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Let's go down. We'll go down that. Let's see. I want to get to many more letters, and we go to Matt. I'm having a hard time with what the president is doing also, but can you explain to me how it's fair if we charge them 3% tariff and they charge us 15%? To 20%, how is that fair to us?
Oh my gosh! So if I'm standing at the Mexican border and somebody wants to sell me, I don't know, a piggy bank, right? And there's nothing in the way, and he says, "Well, would you like to pay a dollar for this piggy bank, or would you like to pay $1.06 and we'll give $6 to the government?" I want to pay a dollar for that piggy bank all day long. So there's no, it's not this Trumpian notion that every exchange is, as you say, a zero-sum game, or somebody has to be exploiting the other person. It's just it's a wrong notion from the start. Once you accept it, you get into this maelstrom of thought that you almost can't make logical sense of. But you just got to think about that border's artificial, right? The fact that the gentleman or woman or person on the other side is from a different country is artificial. If they've got something of value and they want to provide it to me at a price that's competitive and worth my while to buy it, well, then so be it. Now, if the government wants, the U.S. government wants to step in and take a little bit of a cut, you know, because they're helping to administrate the border and organize trade between countries, I get it. But then when it starts to become prohibitive, it doesn't make any sense. So is it fair to our manufacturers that their government stands in the way and charges a fee on the other side of that transaction? So if I want to sell him soybeans and the Mexican government wants to take a 40% cut, is that fair? No. And does it harm U.S. soybean manufacturers? To some extent, but we got to go around the whole world and find homes for our soybeans. So you know, it's to think about it in a zero-sum way sort of get you all confused. To think about it as a set of transactions that benefit both sides is a better way to look at it.
We go to Sally. My fear is that he has a different horrible motive to destroy our country for his and Putin's fun and games and personal gains. He doesn't care about anything else. We got a lot of letters on in that vein. Let's see.
It is true. He's a lame duck. He's not running for re-election. He doesn't have to care about his popularity.
That's
not
what he said earlier this week.
And it is true that Russia was not on the list. I mean, the rationale being that they were already under so many sanctions that they didn't need to have a tariff put on them.
I think our level of trade with Russia is pretty much near the bottom.
I the one thing I would say is if you look back at Trump even to when he was sitting in his faux gold tower in the 80s, he's always thought of trade deficits as a sign of somebody.
That was faux gold?
I don't. Maybe it was real.
So disappointing.
Maybe it was all real.
It looks
I'm sorry.
So good on television. Yeah. Okay.
But my point is, he's been consistently wrong on this point.
Is that faux gold hair, too? is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. Well, you could talk about a lot of his relationships, too, and start asking about what's. But anyway.
Yes.
He's been pretty consistently wrong, so I'll give him the benefit of the doubt that he's always been stupid as opposed to being just nefarious now. Or at least I should say wrong on this point.
Let's go to Mike. Trump is fond of saying "Make America Great Again" instead of returning to a time of tariffs. Why doesn't he return to historical income tax rates from those times? In the 1940s through early 60s, the top income tax rate was over 90%. Today, it's 37% before loopholes for the rich. Parker says, good morning. Can someone please explain how tariffs help stop fentanyl from crossing the border? Riddle me this, Batman. She did not say that part. That was my addition, but go ahead. Anyone?
I think it's reasonable to say that the pressure put on Sheinbaum probably, a lot of what she announced in response to that pressure was stuff that was happening anyway. I suspect they're looking a little more closely at some of those packages, but I think it's not why we're doing this, and you can certainly look at the alleged 42 pounds a year that come in from Canada and just say it doesn't make any sense.
It seems like Trump would have us believe that if we put a tariff on, say, Chinese imports, that China pays it. Is he lying, ignorant, or both? Then we go to this letter from David. Trump's plan to make the rich richer and put everyone else in a state of chaos is where it is at. Panel, this is to the panel from Melinda. So Trump has placed tariffs on islands in the Pacific and Indian Oceans that most have never even heard of, that are populated only by sea animals along with the rest of the world, but none on Russia. Someone has to put a stop to this craziness.
No, we already have a lot of restrictions on Russia, and he's threatening even more. I think the, you know, Trump in cahoots with Russia theory, I think sometimes, and even with this trade policy, what Trump does is so illogical, so unplanned, so emotional, and so arbitrary that people slip into conspiracy theories to explain what he's doing. And I understand that, but I don't often think they really fit. I think just sort of stupidity and emotionalism are better explanations.
You know, you quoted the Treasury Secretary saying, take a breath. If you don't like the tariff we've imposed, come and talk to us.
Well, I didn't quote him saying, come talk to me. He said, give it some thought because you're going to lose a war. The subtext was, give us a call.
But the thing is, Netanyahu was just like a few days ago announced that Israel was wiping out its tariffs on trade with the U.S. And yet yesterday's announcement included a big tariff on Israel. And so I was just surprised by that. I don't know what the backstory is.
Phyllis writes, I just want you to know the $24 socks from Vermont have a lifetime warranty. I'm not kidding, says Phyllis. That's not bad.
I may have those same socks.
I mean, I have those socks too. Yeah.
I have to say, they do. They, my dog just eats them, so it doesn't cover that for the warranty.
I bet it does. Some of those warranties are crazy. Like if you, well, anyway.
Now your dog's gonna have to eat those cheap Chinese.
Well, no, we have to give the dog Ipecac to have it go out the right end, so it doesn't go out the other end.
But Phyllis's ardent defense of her socks makes my point. And there's nothing wrong if you want a pair of socks on your feet that you have an emotional attachment to the brand. God bless you. That's great. And if that makes you happier, then spend your money that way. And if it promotes U.S. jobs as part of it, that's great.
If you can afford $24 socks, but what if you've got a family of four, and they go through a lot of socks?
No, there are some families that can't. That story doesn't matter. Having a kid with socks where the holes aren't too big, right, is the choice they're making. Yeah, that's a good point.
We got this letter that says, classic look in the mirror moment, clump.
Clump.
Take two. I'm going to read a different letter. Russ says the decades over which multinational corporations moved production out of the country still left the U.S. with a healthy services-based employment regime. The effort to reverse that model will take years. There are no cell phones assembled in this country and no electric vehicles apart from Teslas. If business decides the current administration will maintain trade barriers for many years, they may begin to start the 3 to 5 year process of setting up manufacturing in the U.S. if they can find some place where the labor would be available. Then we go to John. Liberation Day. What in the George Orwell's 1984 is that? Greatest day in American history? Yeah, for Putin, Trump's boss. But for the U.S., Trump's tariff-o-rama has poisoned all of our relationships with our allies. Our allies will never forgive us, not for decades. Our soon-to-be ex-allies will no longer put up with our nonsense and will start routing their economic lines around the United States of America, economically isolating us. And then the U.S. will economically sink like a lead brick, and Putin will sit there and laugh and laugh and laugh. That from John.
Two things for the previous letter writer. Rivians are also built, I think, almost exclusively in the United States.
Yes.
And I do think we do have to, with the last letter, all of this is bad. It's going to cost, the estimates of what it's going to cost the average American middle class family, if this comes to pass, is somewhere in the $4,000 to $10,000. I've heard different estimates. I mean, it's going to be really painful, but we're not likely to sink into a depression, and we're not likely to not be the world's wealthiest country on a per head GDP basis. It's going to take a long time for us to, you know, for somebody else to rise and us to tread water for that to happen. So I do think we have to be I don't want to quote Scott Bessent, but I think we have to take a breath. I mean, this is really going to hurt lots of people, particularly the more economically vulnerable. That's Trump's tradecraft, isn't it? But, you know, the United States is too big a ship to sink that quickly.
Hakan says, classic look in the mirror moment, Trump claiming that everyone is ripping us off because he, shouty caps, he rips everyone off. That from Hakan. Then we go to Joe, who says the stock market is tumbling. Trump enacted the biggest tax increase on middle and working class Americans in history, and economists agree that we are heading towards recession. So my question for the journalists in the room, okay, I think that's just you, Judy, but here we go. Why? Well, no, Bill, no, too, Bill, actually. Bill, too.
A recovering journalist.
Why the heck isn't this the headlines of the Times Union and the Daily Gazette and every single city newspaper in this country?
I think a lot of newspapers led with this morning. I can't speak for the Times Union.
Right.
But, the media are not ignoring this story.
Right. And there's so many facets to the story. And every day there are 1,000 stories you can put at the top of your of your homepage or on your front page. And so you have to choose.
In the Naked City.
In the Naked. And so they have to choose. But clearly, this is the story. The question is how to follow. The luckiest man in the country today is Mike Waltz, because this has taken some pressure off him on the signal gate, because nobody's talking about that, which clearly would be the top topic, because he apparently continues to use unsafe forms of communication. So, you know, the news shifts back and forth. Cable tends to focus on one story all day long. I think what you get from a major media company like, you know, even NPR, New York Times, even small newspapers, you get a variety of news. And so you can go and read about more than one topic every day.
If I were a shark, I'd still be circling or below Mike Waltz. Just be a couple more days.
You know, speaking of things that aren't getting covered because
yes.
of all the...
Yes.
I don't know if people are aware of this, but the state prison system has decided to, like, early release for a bunch of its prisoners because it doesn't have enough guards because of, you know, a wildcat strike and guard... Like, the prisons are, like, having a meltdown right now. And the governor, through her commissioner, is responding to that by just releasing a bunch of prisoners early. No one even has heard about it because it's all being drowned out by events in Washington.
Then we're not. I mean, there are a thousand stories to cover. Again, there's the immigration stories. There are the free speech stories. There's the funding for research institutes. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why I thought the Cory Booker long speech the other day was so impactful, was the fact that there is so much to cover. It took him 25 hours to get through it all.
Well, it also took him 25 hours to read all of his mail, which I have to say, we could do that. Not for 25
And he
hours,
says he did not use a diaper.
Yeah, well,
that's
good
a right.
For him.
That's a right wing talking point. It's so crass.
Oh, you're yeah. not allowed bathroom breaks?
Mm-mm.
Correct.
Oh, that's a game changer. Wow. I think a lot differently of Cory Booker than I used to.
No, I thought, well, it was impressive by, I think, many standards, and I don't know. I thought it's a neat story. But anyway, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll finish up with this group. We have a couple more stories to discuss, and we'll do that with Judy and Bill and Mark, and we welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We will return after this break in news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion as we wrap up on this Thursday morning. Let's get to the rumor and conjecture part of the morning. Liberal demonstrators for weeks have been holding up signs declaring no one voted for Elon Musk. On Tuesday, voters in Wisconsin got the chance. Musk's chosen candidate lost decisively in the state Supreme Court election, delivering by far the biggest rebuke to the billionaire who has hovered over American politics since July and raising questions about his future role in the Trump administration. The election unexpectedly developed into a clash between President Trump's personality-driven politics, as represented by Musk's flashy style, and the time-honored traditions of American democracy. At least for the moment, those traditions reasserted themselves. The role of Musk, who is overseeing a controversial cost-cutting operation for Trump, made the race in part a referendum on him, said Barry Burden, director of the University of Wisconsin's Elections Research Center. He is such an unusual person, and he has this outsized influence in what is going on, Burden said of Musk, who was listed by Forbes as the world's richest person. So that concern fit the narrative of what he was doing in the Wisconsin race, throwing his weight around and using his wealth. It was just a step too far for a lot of voters. In Tuesday's vote, which will probably cement liberals' control of the Wisconsin Supreme Court for the next 3 years, Susan Crawford, the candidate supported by Democrats, defeated Brad Schimmel, who had the enthusiastic backing of Trump and Musk, and it was 55-45%. No one has personified Trump's determination to circumvent the traditional process of government and politics more than Musk, an ostentatious and powerful personality. He has been slashing and rearranging the federal government and attacking individual agencies despite holding no official position and making sweeping and offering false pronouncements. So a lot of frustration, and with this result, it is now being rumored throughout the D.C. area that Elon Musk's time within the Trump administration perhaps is coming to an end. Trump has said that he believes it is winding down. And also there is his business, Tesla, which is, I think politely, tanking. So the question is, I guess this was still, do we buy the stories, number one? Number two, how bad of a situation would this be for the richest man in the world? And three, are we seeing what would be a clean break, or is there no such thing in the Trump orbit?
You know, I've been waiting ever since this relationship got started. I've been waiting for how it was going to come apart. It's lasted longer than I would have guessed. Apparently, under some federal law, he's like temporary employee. He has to be done by May anyway. I did think when the very next day, the day after those Wisconsin results came out, there was a story, I think it was in the Washington Post, quoting insiders saying that the president thought Musk should back away now. It was a little bit too neat, I guess, but on the other hand, that is kind of how the president seems to think. You know, if somebody blows an election, he's not friends with that person anymore. It was a further demonstration that Elon Musk is just really bad at politics. His thought that he can go in a judicial election and throw a lot of money around and claim that it's the end of civilization. I mean, in one of the pieces of coverage I read, they said that in these elections, typically the Democrat wins by about 12 points, and in this case, they won by 10 points. And so Elon Musk, you know, maybe narrowed the result a little bit, but he certainly didn't swing the race.
Boy, and to those people who got the million-dollar checks, good for them. Like,
I hope they cashed them already.
Well, yeah, that's right.
You know, people have power.
They're big, though. I don't know how you get them through the front door.
They're take real? A photo.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But, yeah, take a photo nowadays. You can do that. But, you know, people have power, like Musk, because we give them power. I mean, Trump invested him with power. I think Musk thought he was in the same mold as Trump, that he had the same charisma, that he could get away with the same kind of falderal that Trump does. And, you know what? I find him on uniquely unlikable. I find this that the media, I blame in part because they have built him up as this, you know, super smart, super wealthy guy that can do no wrong. I just think he's unlikable by the, he talks down to people. Trump gets away with this. For some reason, the every man likes the way that Trump approaches a speech. Musk just can't do it. I thought he'd be gone by out of the orbit by the 1st of July or by Independence Day. But the inside the Beltway, we were hearing rumors about established Republicans wanted him gone as well. Nobody in Washington aside from Trump really enjoyed
Lee Zeldin.
And Lee Zeldin.
Yeah. Supposedly in that meeting when some of the cabinet members were complaining.
Sounding off, yeah.
Lee Zeldin said, I don't have any problem with him. So
there you go. Mark?
Well, I think it's been an interesting political transformation for Musk. There was a piece in Nate Silver's newsletter or bulletin that goes through his progression. I refer readers to it. I don't know if that particular piece is behind the paywall or not, but it was pretty interesting. I think the issue, by the way, just if you think back at Elon Musk in his early days, I wonder what that kindergarten review read. It was like great with blocks, but does not play well with others, right? And that's still what he faces. He still doesn't kind of get the tonal interaction of human beings in a way that the rest of us do. Rolling into Wisconsin with big checks is one thing, but rolling into Wisconsin physically with the cheese hat on your head in a case where you're not sure of a victory is another thing in Donald Trump's world. I actually think there's a pretty good or fortunate confluence between that 130-day limit. By the way, I don't think Trump would have held to it if he didn't want to, but I think there's a way to use that as an excuse to get the cheese head off of his head, to get him, Musk, off the stage. But to still, the one thing I think the Republicans, including Trump, still want to do is benefit from the checks, you know, in the tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of dollar range that he can write and threaten to write, particularly in primaries, to keep the Republicans in line. So I think there's a moment at which Elon Musk sort of takes a step back, goes back to Austin to help SpaceX and particularly Tesla. It's an open question whether or not, given where Tesla is in its progression as a company, that his talents are the ones, his Musk's talents are the ones needed to fix it. But I do think he'll go back, give it a go, take a less visible role. But I think the Republicans want to do whatever it takes within reason to make sure that his checkbook and the threat of that checkbook are still available to him, to them, the Republicans, because I think we underestimate how important that's been in terms of keeping the Republicans at the national level and even potentially at the state level in line.
And it's true that Musk has taken the heat for all the cutbacks at the federal level in terms of, you know, the layoffs and the, you know, the drastic approach to reducing the size of government. I mean, that heat has not been on Donald Trump. It's been on Elon Musk. And that has done him a very strong political service.
But see, you know, Donald Trump can hire somebody who probably is no less effective at what Donald Trump wants done. Not that we think in this room that's a good thing, but Elon Musk is an unnecessary lightning rod in a lot of ways. And also a lot of the conflicts that he has, I have to imagine that at some point the courts start to catch up with him. And you can basically get somebody who's nearly as effective, who doesn't have that baggage. The trick is keeping him happy in terms of writing those checks.
I mean, to Judy's point, when they had was it last weekend, the UFC fight, and Trump walks in, I can't believe I'm saying this, but okay. And Trump walks in, and the place goes nuts, and then Elon walks in, and they all boo. And
he was the heel.
That's right. You know, and that's your point. You know, and without that, does that change? Does that equation change any? And I don't know. I understand Mark's point of you just find somebody else to do it to become the lightning rod, right?
Yeah, I think you can. I think you also find somebody who's not quite as burdened. I think, you know, the Democrats, I think, have got a pretty handy slogan in place for the midterms, which is the tax cuts that are going to benefit Elon Musk and Donald Trump's rich friends. Unfortunately, for the Democrats, I think the Republicans are going to make that equation a little bit more difficult by obscuring Elon Musk's or dampening Elon Musk's role in the cost cutting.
The last story we will do, and I only have 2 minutes for this, but the Republican Speaker of the House, his name is Mike Johnson, in case you forgot. And he is now digging in against proxy voting. And what this is showing is that he is having trouble. Speaker Mike Johnson's failed effort this week to shut down a bipartisan bid to allow new parents in Congress to vote remotely after the birth of a child highlighted the limits of his power and intensified a fight that has ground the House to a halt. The clash underscored yet again how dependent the speaker has been on President Trump to keep Republicans in line. And it raised questions about whether Mr. Johnson, in his haste to transform the House into an organ of compliance to the president, may have lost sight of the importance of gauging what rank-and-file lawmakers will and will not tolerate.
You know, I'm all in favor of enabling parents of young children to be able to participate, especially when they are members of Congress. But I frankly was annoyed because the one thing they're going to stand up for is something that makes it more convenient for them. They, all the other things, they're going to, you know, just go ahead, do whatever you want. The one thing that they'll have a little bit of spine about is this. Again, I am in favor of recognizing the modern workplace and enabling people to vote by proxy, especially if they have small children. But this thing just rankled me.
Yeah. This is what they got upset about. Yeah. Bill?
Well, I also thought, like, I have to say, I mean, on its surface, the idea that you want to make an accommodation for somebody who's just given birth, but in the course of this debate, it went from being, you know, a limited number of weeks just for the mother, and then it became a longer number of weeks, and it included fathers, and you can imagine the list of rationales for allowing proxy voting getting longer and longer and longer, and people spending less time in Washington and less time in the chamber.
I just realized we have completely run out of time, but my thanks to everyone for being here. Mark, Bill, Judy, you're all wonderful. We'll be back right after this.